It opens a lot of opportunity for building the relationship much stronger. So for the US and EU to link together now, hopefully with two strong climate laws, and be good allies to India, to South Africa, to Brazil, and think through how to do this globally, how to build supply chains globally, because that's what's going to need to happen.
Hello, and welcome back to the Climate Bridge podcast. My name is Mary Helmick, and I am a consultant at the Berlin-based climate think tank Adelphi and co-lead of the program office of the Transatlantic Climate Bridge, the initiative behind this podcast.
Hello, and I am Ola Adolfsson, a member of Polis 180, a young grassroots think tank on European and foreign policy based in Berlin, and a partner institution of the Transatlantic Climate Bridge. Together with Mary, I'm hosting today's episode.
The goal of the Transatlantic Climate Bridge and of this podcast is to promote climate cooperation between Germany, the United States, and Canada. Stay tuned through the end of the episode to learn more about the Transatlantic Climate Bridge. All right, so in our second episode of season two, we are stepping back and taking a macro look at the state of the transatlantic relationship. Last year, the United States passed the Inflation Reduction Act, or the IRA, or IRA, which was the largest climate bill in U.S. history and is one of the largest climate financing acts in the world. And while the European Union celebrated the United States leading on climate action, the legislation also sparked significant transatlantic tensions. In the wake of the IRA, the European Union itself has come out with new plans to lead on industrial policy and green manufacturing, with the Green Deal Industrial Plan and the Net Zero Industry Act coming on the scene in early 2023. So for today's episode, we are going to dive into the state of play of the United States and the European Union's flagship climate legislations, and we'll learn how industrial policy and international trade affect the transatlantic relationship, and in general, have massive impacts on countries' plans to combat the climate crisis and get along in the process.
And to do just that, we are joined by two very distinguished transatlantic climate experts. First is Jesse Scott, who's a visiting research fellow at the Deutsches Institut für Wirtschaftsforschung and an adjunct faculty at the Hertie School in Berlin. She's an expert on all things European Union and climate, with her current work focusing on EU gas and electricity market reforms, EU external action on the energy transition, as well as EU Green Deal policies and politics. And second, Mike Williams is a senior fellow at the Washington, D.C.-based Center for American Progress, where his work focuses on the nexus between creating and retaining high-quality union jobs and fighting the climate crisis. In his previous role at the Blue-Green Alliance, Mike led the organization's work on climate change, energy, manufacturing, and labor policy.
I had the opportunity to speak with Jesse and Mike together, so let's go ahead and dive into the conversation. Okay, so thank you, Jesse and Mike, for joining us. It's great to have you here. And as you both already know, the topic for this episode is the intersection between international trade, industrial policy, and the health of the transatlantic relationship. Now, before we dive into our discussion, I think it would be helpful for our listeners to hear why these topics actually matter for climate change. I know personally, when I talk about my work on industrial decarbonization to my friends and family, I see their eyes start to glaze over a little bit. Could you both tell us why these seemingly unsexy topics are actually very important to both national and international climate action?
Oh, Mary, what's unsexy about hundreds of billions of dollars or euros for tackling the world's definitive crisis? And I know that's, you know, a sort of scary headline, but climate change is heat waves, it's drought, it's floods, it's all the impacts they bring for food security, the economy. And actually, about three quarters of the climate change problem is linked to energy. And we have a massive job to do to shift to clean energy production. So I don't know what's unsexy about that. But if you want it in one sentence, climate change is water. Too much, too little, wrong time, wrong place, and the impacts that play out from that. Now, Mike's going to tell us the positive version of this. He's going to tell us why the green economy is the exciting bit with the jobs. Go for it, Mike.
You're setting me up to be an eternal optimist, and I tend to be like that. So I appreciate that, Jesse. I like the climate change is water. I like that a lot. I've got a different one, but it doesn't necessarily have to be in conflict. Climate change is infrastructure, or the climate problem is an infrastructure problem, because you talk about industrial decarbonization. I was like, okay, well, that sounds ephemeral. What does that even mean? But you know, what is this seltzer can or my iPhone? What are they made of? They're made of materials. They're made of aluminum. They have steel. They have all copper and other things in them that have to come from some place and have to be made in some place in some manner. And they have to use energy that comes from someplace in made in some manner. And so climate change is the decision on how we do all that, right? And so we've been doing it for 100 years. And I say we, and especially a person from the UK, a person from the US, Mary from the US, but is in Germany. We are from the Western world, and we have done this over the last 100 years. And we've done it in a way that has dumped pollution into the atmosphere and has caused the climate crisis. And Jesse just, you know, stated clearly why that's a huge problem. And I don't think we need to get into why it's a huge problem, but we've made these decisions over the last 100 years to make steel, to make energy, to move our goods and ourselves from place to place in a way that causes significant amounts of pollution to go into the atmosphere that causes climate change. We now are in a moment where we can do all of those things without throwing pollution into the atmosphere. And so you working on industrial decarbonization is basically saying, we're going to make this thing without making sea levels rise further. To me, that's what it means. And it's incredibly important. And the thing is, especially today, making things like this, but especially things like this, require vast global cooperation, global supply chains. We felt this in COVID when the auto supply chain went locked down, when multiple other supply chains got screwed up. We are all deeply connected in our goods and our materials. And so figuring this out is going to mean global cooperation.
I wish I could take that soundbite and make kind of a digital business card to take with me as I go around, because I think it would be much more effective. I mean, I guess the people I'm meeting already care about industrial decarbonization, but maybe to family reunions to explain what I do. Yeah, thank you for this explanation. Very concise, very on the nose, and sets us up beautifully for our next question, which I'm going to direct to you, Mike, to bring us this perspective from the US. So last year, as most of our listeners will know, the United States passed its biggest piece of climate legislation in history, the Inflation Reduction Act, or the IRA. This bill, which came close to not passing at all, put the U.S. back on the global climate stage after the Trump administration pulled the country out of the Paris Agreement. And it includes an estimated $369 billion in investments over the next decade. Could you tell us how this bill came to be and speak to how the U.S. does climate policy in general?
Okay, so we have 2 hours for this lecture, right? Or more? Because we could start in the 90s.
Yeah.
Talk about 2 hours. Yeah, perfect. And with the BTU tax, we could start in 2009 or so, when Barack Obama was elected president and a comprehensive cap and trade bill passed the United States House of Representatives, only to fail spectacularly in the United States Senate. Didn't come terribly close. President Obama did actually still lean into trying to do something and be productive on climate change using the administrative authority, the regulatory authority of the U.S.'s Environmental Protection Agency and other landmark laws like the Clean Air Act. That changed when a different person was elected in 2016 in the United States. We don't want to necessarily go into that. And also the Supreme Court decided that what President Obama did was illegal. And so it threw the whole thing out. So then there was a big old reevaluation. How are we doing climate policy in the U.S.? We keep failing and failing and failing and failing and failing. And there was a really strong inward look at what do we do here? And so a lot of folks did this. It took some time. I was part of it, worked with the labor movement, talked to working people, and realized that our climate policy needed to be inextricably linked to a pro-worker investment policy and came up with, put a number of years and months into thinking through what that could be in 2017, 2018, 2019. A number of organizations came out with these big, broad ideas. One, I was with the Blue Green Alliance. We came out with the Solidarity for Climate Action platform. This laid this out. The Green New Deal came out around then. Number of other big ideas around a climate investment comprehensive policy that centered working people. And it just so happened the 2020 presidential campaign started up around then. And there was about 75 different people running for the Democratic nomination. And literally all of them were latching onto this as the platform. And it was truly of who could do better. Joe Biden was elected president. That for the climate, that's a really good thing. For everything else as well, in my humble opinion. And he took that, he took that campaign promise, that campaign platform of a comprehensive climate investment policy that was worker-centered, and put out a policy platform as president, and it was called Build Back Better. This all got whittled down, and Build Back Better for a while was the piece that was being negotiated on. It got whittled down to at most $2 to $3 trillion possibility. And it included a lot of social and domestic policies. Climate was a big one. Climate had its own plank, and it was about $370 billion to about $450 billion, anywhere in there. In the end, because of politics in the United States being awful most of the time, but, you know, and oftentimes not succeeding, a final piece came together of Build Back Better, and it turned into the Inflation Reduction Act. And nearly every part of Build Back Better got whittled away, either completely, like completely. There's housing policies, there's paid leave policies, just got tossed aside. One of the only ones that did not get tossed aside at all was climate. $369 billion, as you mentioned, remained in there, and which is kind of amazing in a lot of ways. But it did so because it relied on pro-worker investments. There were labor standards incorporated. Pro-American economy investments. There was domestic manufacturing focus in there, and we can get into that too. But that was required for this to actually have the political oomph to pass. And it was climate, because of that worker element, stayed, unlike everything else, nearly everything else. And so then, you know, we can get into the last days of negotiations where weird things happened with the electric vehicle tax credit, but we don't need to do that now. Like I said, we don't actually have 2 hours. But then it passed, which is extraordinary. And so how does U.S. do climate policy? sclerotically, ridiculously, luckily sometimes. We do U.S. climate policy like we do politics. It's about moments. It's about movements. It's about advocacy. It's about finding every way possible to get something done, because in the interim of that ridiculous, and I was only talking about federal climate policy, where we weren't getting anything done federally, multiple states were making movements and putting forward efforts to expand clean energy policy, expand energy efficiency policy. Efforts with pushing the private sector to do better were happening. So the U.S. does climate policy in a haphazard, but I think at least positive manner, because there's just a lot of people focusing on it. And so that's not a great answer to the second part, but it's the truth.
Great. I think we do climate policy the way we do politics could be the kind of backdoor motto of the IRA. And that actually is a perfect segue, because the politics element, the political economy behind climate policy in the US is so important to then the later part of our discussion today of how this connects to transatlantic relations is key. So now, Jesse, I'd like to turn to you. So building off of what Mike just said, the IRA is passed last summer and the world is thrilled to see the US finally making a comeback on climate after 4 years of inaction. But that is not the end of the story. There were also some other less than positive reactions, namely from key allies and close trading partners of the United States, including the European Union, Could you explain the evolution of how the EU and key players in it reacted to the IRA from its passage until now, and what parts of the bill especially stood out to Europeans?
So, Mary, Mike, speaking as a Brit, as a European, as a citizen of the world, we were delighted. We're delighted the US is back. We also live and work in places where politics isn't perfect and sure isn't pretty. That means that when it comes to the IRA or the IRA, we were really glad that the US is moving. We were really glad that there was a signal to the rest of the world that a major economy thinks this is a direction to go in. So perhaps the most important thing in the reaction has been, okay, if they're doing this, maybe we need to do it for our economists too. And that's the reason, Mary, as you get at, that there was sort of both delighted and a little bit defensive, because this is an investment in the US economy, as well as global outcomes. So the EU initial reaction was not us at our best, the EU, the European Union, most of Europe working together. We were a bit grumpy. And some of that was to do with, ooh, this is competition, and we thought we were the sort of global investment green tech leaders. And some of it was, there are some provisions in the Act that basically say to companies, invest in the US, not Europe. But look, the reaction has now matured. And last time we all talked, guys, it was pretty much as that curve was turning. And the reaction is now very much great. Okay, now we up our game. So we have in Europe a Net Zero Investment Act. Now, we don't call our legislation in Europe usually acts. So, you know, this is imitation as the sincerest form of flattery, no question. And we are looking at how we can do something equivalent. We were already doing a European Union Green Deal, so there's more imitation and flattery from the debate, at least, that went into the last US election. But I think there are two big caveats as we look ahead now. One is that the European toolkit is different. So at national level, in Germany, in France, in Italy, in the UK, we can do tax breaks. But at the European Union level overall, it's not a taxing authority. We have a slightly different toolkit around subsidies and regulations, and that makes the whole story complicated. And if Mike can talk for 2 hours about the history, I can talk for 4.5 about the European toolkit. And by the way, one of the asks from businesses is, please make it less complicated. Part of the appeal of the American model is it's really simple. Okay. The other caveat is, despite being delighted, I see a really important tension. In Europe, we've got a Green Deal. Part of that is a carbon border adjustment mechanism, something called a CBAM. And we all spent much of the last 2 years talking CBAM, CBAM, CBAM. You guys have come in with the IRA. The rest of the world has said, oh, wow, this is interesting, but it's very much about the US and the European economies. It's quite protectionist. And that is in tension with the idea that we have a global need for partnership on climate action. Are we protectionist? Can we be partners if we're protectionist? It's a confusing signal. And I spend a lot of my working life in the rest of the world. And you hear several things. You hear the Paris Agreement on climate is great, 2015, but there's not enough talk about the Paris Declaration of 2005, which was about development aid. The Indian Minister of Power on the IRA said, it's not for transition. It's for making sure that other people are not able to compete. Now, I don't fully agree with him at all, but that's an interesting reaction and one we cannot ignore and we should take seriously and engage with. And if I quote a senior European leader who I met with earlier this summer, he summarized a long discussion about all of this. And he said, you know what? You can only be rich and stupid for one generation. That's what the rest of the world thinks about Europe and climate action. Wow. So, we all know that solving climate change is about a lot of technologies and all those clean technologies Mike was talking about, but the really big growth in emissions is in the big populations with the rapid economic development. In other words, it's in the global south. And we can't just solve it by leading by example. And we can't just solve it by investing in our own economies. We really do need those partnerships. And that means cooperation on investment, on technology, on finance, on debt, on capacity building, on trade, on market access. And as you can tell, this is a topic I'd like to talk about a load more. Back to you, Mary.
Thank you, Jesse, for bringing in that perspective, because I have the feeling that when the IRA or the IRA passed, there was a lot of understandable navel gazing happening. We're in the US, we're thinking, you know, this huge piece of legislation just passed. What does that mean for our economy? Over in Europe, you know, on the one hand, there's celebration for this piece of climate action. On the other hand, there's very real fear and stress about it damaging the EU economy. And I think it took some months before the temperature decreased enough to think about how these pieces of legislation would affect other economies around the world. And I want to return to this topic in a minute, but to first step back and get more of a macro look at all of this, I think it might surprise some of our listeners to learn that trade and industrial policy, again, these very seemingly unsexy topics, actually so significantly affected the strength of the transatlantic relationship, because tensions were pretty high there for a while. You know, they subsided towards the end of last year, but, you know, the transatlantic relationship was shaky for a while. So could the two of you tell us why these topics are so important to diplomatic relations?
So industrial policy is this notion of being proactive with government policy and planning that supports domestic economy, both the domestic workers, but also domestic manufacturing, domestic industries, with specific industries in mind, right? That like just like that's the not to give a textbook definition, but countries across the world have engaged in industrial policy. It tends to be very popular for good reason. It's a way to use government to lift up working people and to think proactively. And if it's done well, you think forward. The US has done this with our defense industrial complex. That's a different example we don't need to get into. But we have not really done this in a while on other private sector focuses. And to do this on climate and clean energy, I can see as something that would react strongly, like, oh my goodness, what are you doing? You're changing the trade norms. But if you don't make climate change, the climate policy action, something that working people think that they have a stake in, that they have a future with, then you get visceral reaction that is politically very bad. Donald Trump in the United States, the shift rightward in Italy, we're seeing some difficult potential shift in Spain and elsewhere. I mean, it's a backlash. And so I'm maybe slightly not answering your question, Mary, because I think it's really important to note that we have to look at climate policy in that vein, in that scope, that if it's not supporting the working people in your country, the working people in your country will toss it out for political reasons. They'll get captured by right-wing populists who will use it as a cudgel and as a wedge. So that all said, and I'm going to stop because Jesse probably has way smarter things to say than I do. There's a way to do this that doesn't crack open transatlantic relationships. There's a way to do this. Now, did IRA do it perfectly? No, but the US was, and not to make huge excuses, but we were constrained by our own politics of how to get something passed. And so the structure of that. Also, I don't think that when it was passed, the United States Senate was thinking, well, how's this going to affect our relationship with the European Union? That wasn't the case. Should it have been? Should folks have worked on that and thought about that? Yes, but it wasn't the case. That said, one final thing. I think the fact that this passed, it opens a lot of opportunity for transatlantic discussion, for building the relationship much stronger. So for the US and EU to link together now, hopefully with two strong climate laws, and be good allies to India, to South Africa, to Brazil, and think through how to do this globally, how to build supply chains globally, because that's what's going to need to happen. And so I think this is just a huge opportunity for that.
I think, Mike, you put your finger on it really with jobs. And I think I've got three things to say there. I mean, first, Mary, I was thinking about your question. It's the economy, stupid, right? It's that famous quote from a previous US election. Going green, in the words of those, you know, hairy radicals at the International Monetary Fund, not, is the comprehensive, rapid restructuring of the global economy. It's about economics. So these are the first big economic packages. And that means, yeah, there's going to be a strong reaction, a lot of thought, and we're on a learning by doing path here. Although the US and the EU are not on total alignment about everything in the world, look, we're pretty close on a lot of things. So I think part of the reason there were some tensions around this is we were a bit surprised when our bilateral relationship, you know, a conflict appears. And we're focusing a lot of effort on solving that because it's a complicated world and, you know, being on bad terms with each other is not going to make it less complicated. Okay. That's it. I'm not greatly worried. And this brings us to the jobs livelihoods thing Mike's talking about. Because actually, I think there's plenty of room for us to move in the same direction. We're in the same direction about a much bigger role for government in the economy and markets in order to deliver that clean, green, climate secure world. I think there's a lot of rethinking about sort of the WTO role in the world compared to the last few decades. And specifically, you know, as an investment act, actually, let's take, you know, green hydrogen. There's a lot of buzz about green hydrogen. Will all the financing on green hydrogen move to the US because of the IRA? No. There's so much investor appetite. It way exceeds the investable projects. It's going to be around the world. Will Buy American requirements lock out others? Well, actually, no, because they're not there on the green hydrogen piece. And the majority, actually, of the companies who are developing green hydrogen technologies are European at the moment. We've been in the lead on this. And we're the home to a lot of what will go on, and if we can diversify that into the world, brilliant. What I really like, though, hydrogen example in the IRA is that, you know, it rewards action more depending on how ambitious it is. You get a modest tax credit for bringing hydrogen into the economy. It's a bigger tax credit if it's hydrogen from electricity, which is part of being green. It's a better tax credit if it's a really green electricity. It's coming from the wind and the solar, the clean stuff. But the maximum tax credit is if you deliver apprenticeships and training courses on this new technology. That's the bit I've been telling my European friends we need to copy, because that's about bringing the jobs, the livelihoods, the practical transition in the economy for everybody. Also, you know, we need to live day by day through this radical transition. And skills in the workforce are going to be fundamental to that and a really important topic for the rest of the way forward.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I mean, this linking of climate and jobs is a huge part of the American story, as you laid out for us, Mike. And I think what I hear, and, you know, as you said, Jesse, what I'm also hearing here is that this is not something that the EU has been doing as well. And, you know, in the spirit of imitation is the highest form of flattery, then maybe this is another thing that could be exported. So keeping an eye on time, I'd like to take, you know, everything that we just discussed and kind of distill it into, where is the transatlantic relationship now? Is it rocky? Is it stronger than ever? What are the potential forks in the road up ahead that could improve or jeopardize the relationship? And going back to partnerships, you know, is there any room for cooperation, harmonization on these domestic policies in Europe, in the US, and bringing in third countries into the mix?
I'm going to jump in first because I want to make sure Jesse has the final word on this, because, you know, I think, you know, we're talking the transatlantic climate relationship. There's other parts of the transatlantic relationship, but with regards to climate, stronger than ever. I don't know about that, but it's good. I'm with Jesse. I'm feeling optimistic about it, and there's a lot of opportunity and possibility, and there are things happening right now. So there are negotiations on how we link our work on decarbonizing steel and aluminum production. So it's called the Global Arrangement for Sustainable Steel and Aluminum, so that those are ongoing. That's incredibly important. If we can figure that out, we've then figured out and locked hands on the most trade exposed industries that are some of the most polluting industries in the world, and figured out a path forward that starts with the US and EU, but is in a structure that will then bring in and is open, like has a handout to South Africa, to India, to Brazil, to others, to say, join us, to Canada, to Mexico, and let's figure this out. And it's a true leadership moment. So I think that's an example. The work that the EU has done in critical mineral supply chain is an example, and how the US is starting to engage with that, how to figure that out. So I see it as it's definitely not rocky. I don't think so, at least from the US side. That could just be my US naivete. But it's something where there's just a lot of opportunity ahead of us.
I'd like to see some more things go into that agenda. The agenda as far as it exists, yeah, it's a good one. But I'd like to see a lot more work on what we call in Europe, the circular economy. What do we mean by the circular economy? We mean repairing things rather than chucking them on a trash heap, which is a huge waste of materials and creates a lot of trash that we're not very good at managing. Repairing, repurposing, finding second lives for things. Electric car batteries can be repurposed to support electric grids as their second life. And ultimately recycling. You know, there's a lot of very valuable minerals, Mike's mentioned minerals in that smartphone he was waving around earlier. Those need to be recycled and reused. We can't just keep sort of saying more and more material. There are 8 billion people on Earth. So I'd like to see us lead on this. Why lead on this particularly as the US and the European Union? Because we're the places with the world's wealthy and we consume more. So we need to get this consumption part of delivering on climate, managing circularity, and sort that out and help deliver that model to the rest of the world. We can't ask India to lead on it. It has enormous materials demands, but it's also got an enormous population who still live with very few goods compared to the lives that we lead. The G7, famous G7 group, is 10% of the world population, 30% of world GDP. The Global South, 85% of the world population, 40% of GDP. I want that circularity agenda to be something that the Americans and the Europeans pick up together and say, we've got to lead responsibility on this, and it's going to be more efficient and effective and more valuable to the rest of the world if we come up with a common framework. And that's where the harmonization bit comes in, I think, Mary.
That's an excellent point to end on. And it also kind of harkens to the entire purpose of specifically the transatlantic climate bridge, which is why are we having these conversations in a transatlantic framework and context? And it's because if we can get agreement here, harmonization here, then that can place the whole world on a fast track because of the power, the money, the influence that exists in these places. Jesse, final thoughts?
I just want to say one last thing, because we started this conversation with climate change. And this is really about 8 billion people sharing the planet, coping with the appalling risks of climate change, doing so in a way that protects nature and biodiversity, which are huge economic assets, as well as beautiful things. And that brings me to people saying, oh, but isn't it impossible? I just want to say one thing. You know, you'll hear a lot in the next year about the Paris Agreement target, trying to keep global warming, climate change impacts effects on average global temperatures to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Well, we will struggle with that. But the best response I've heard on this comes from a leading climate scientist who works transatlantically. We said, look, okay, if we can't quite achieve 1.5 Celsius, then let's fight for 1.51. And if we miss that, let's fight for 1.52, 1.53. Every decimal makes a difference. So please, anybody out there thinking about these topics, listening to this podcast, remember, we've got a lot of work to do. And it's not that, you know, it's a we didn't achieve 1.5, the Paris Agreement is behind us, we forget about this stuff. This is a fundamental mission, and it's a fundamental shift in the global economy. And really, in a sense, all the policies we've been talking about are catching up with that and trying to make it land well so that it delivers jobs and goods and quality of life in the US, in Europe, around the world.
Well, thank you, Mary. That was great. Such an informative conversation. I think I could have listened to the two of them for a few more hours. I think it was very good to have a look at the tensions between that the IRA created. Now, with, you know, a bit of hindsight, I think we got the sense that tensions have definitely gone down a bit. The overall sense seems to be that cooperation into the future is possible, and that, you know, all the issues that we thought might be insurmountable with the IRA and the EU seem to be at least in the midterm surmountable. And transatlantic climate cooperation, honestly, I think is looking better than it's looked for a few years now, right?
I would agree. I mean, things are definitely better, especially if we're talking, you know, intersection between transatlantic relations and climate, right? I mean, things are much better now than they were during the Trump administration, but even a lot better than they were, you know, 9 months ago. Towards the end of 2022, tensions were really high, and it didn't seem quite clear how there could be a path forward. But it seems very clear that the Biden administration prioritizes significantly the relationship with the European Union. And we've seen that as well. I mean, the IRA came out, kind of first reactions were very positive, but then we got into the details a little bit more and tensions were kind of emerging. But then towards the end of 2022, we had some very high level European Union leaders going to the US, talking to the Biden administration. And, you know, what we heard, the correspondence from the White House at that time was, we're very keen to work with our partners, you know, across the pond. And immediately since then, we already saw some adjustments to the Inflation Reduction Act that benefited the European Union. Leased electric vehicles are able to qualify for IRA funding. This was not a guarantee right away. This has come out after the Treasury Department has gone forward with its implementation rules of the legislation. So there's a lot of energy to make this work and to make industrial policy on both sides a mutually reinforcing movement, I think.
Indeed. That's, I think, the sense I got as well in listening to Mike and Jesse, in that, honestly, I think a lot of the tensions and issues that were so prominent for, you know, maybe 6 to 9 months kind of came down to communications issues, as in the Europeans didn't quite understand the IRA in the beginning, which, you know, is understandable. It's, from a European perspective,
who did?
extremely complicated.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it took some time until first they realized that they were affected, and then it took some time for the US administration to, you know, recognize that the European concerns were, you know, valid and that they had to respond. And it seems that they did. And, you know, maybe they should have thought about more about how, you know, to communicate this whole package. But on the other hand, it's also clear that the IRA is so complex that their energies were kind of spent on the domestic front. And then as well, the Europeans, I think, would have to try to understand the kind of peculiarities of US politics a bit better, and that had to be explained to them over, you know, a long process as well. And once both sides were kind of agreeing on what each is able to do going forward, especially when it comes to climate politics and what different approaches they could take, and then they would also see the complementarities between the two. So yeah, I think overall industrial policy across the Atlantic is on the right track.
I think so too. And you know, we saw in this conversation how important it is to understand the connection between climate and workers in the US. That's all we get. We get that or we get nothing. And while that's it's understandable that that, you know, causes tensions, I think both sides recognizing that and seeing how can we work within this has made a big difference.
Exactly. And of course, climate is not a topic where you have, you know, the luxury to wait a few decades until the politics might be more amenable to what you're trying to do. And honestly, I think overall, the most important message communications-wise that should be taken on in Europe is that those kind of particular requirements in the bill might be what actually makes the bill stick long-term, because that has to be kind of the central challenge going forward for transatlantic climate cooperation, as to how can you still have climate policy in the US if there, you know, is potentially a different administration next year or, you know, in 5 years and so on. We can't afford to have a breakdown in climate cooperation every 4 or 8 years. So everything that makes climate policy stick in the US, I think, is fully in the interest of Europe as well.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really good point. And I think that's one of the main attractions of the Inflation Reduction Act, that it's money, right? It's giving people money. People famously like getting money, and they don't like money getting taken away from them. And so I think when the next administration comes around, you know, whenever that is, it would be very unpopular to undo the Inflation Reduction Act. And I think, you know, the workers, whether they're from a red state or a blue state, will also value these protections in them and in the bill for them. And I think these elements can also play a big role in kind of future-proofing climate policy in the US, which when it comes down to it is one of the most important things for transatlantic climate relations.
Of course. I think that's really important. And I mean, looking at the even wider strategic context, I think another element that is significant about the IAA, which we haven't really talked about today, but which would come in our next section, is that the IAA, of course, plays a very specific role in the geostrategic competition between the US, the West, vis-a-vis China, as in it tries to also build up a green manufacturing base in the US. That means that not all the equipment for the green transition has to be imported from China, and that, you know, that the dependencies are not too big to be manageable. And with that, I think I would transition to our German word section. Mary, over to you.
Yeah, so in each Climate Bridge podcast, we like to give a small German lesson. As someone who is currently battling to learn the German language, I can speak to how helpful it is to infuse it wherever you can. And we know that English speakers love German compound words. So in our segment, there's a German word for that. We dive into one tailored to each episode. What's today's word, Ola?
Well, today's word is Risikominderung.
Oh gosh, you chose one with a lot of R's. Risikominderung. How was that?
That's great, Mary. That's great. Thank you. Well, you know, my German word today, I think, is somewhat unusual for our section. It's got a lot of R's, but it's only 6 syllables long, and it's already quite
only
popular.
Only six.
6 very short syllables long. It's already quite popular. Earlier, we heard about how the Europeans have already adopted the wording of ACT, of the Inflation Reduction Act, in response to the IRA. So I thought we'd go for a term that has traveled the opposite direction. And again, Risikominderung is a niche word in German, but you might know it by its extremely popular English version of de-risking. Mm. And de-risking is, of course, extremely significant politically. It's kind of become the framework that stops short of decoupling and allows for a continued international climate cooperation in the relation between the US, the West, and China, of course, the world's biggest emitter of CO2. And it has also allowed the US and Europe to kind of align their approaches to China, at least on a rhetorical level. And Mary, you might already know that the Biden administration has picked up the term from the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen. She introduced de-risking in a, you know, big and very well-received speech in March of this year. And von der Leyen for that gets a lot of credit. What is interesting is that apparently the word actually was first used in this context by German Chancellor Scholz, who started to use the term Risikominderung or de-risking to talk about the West's relation to China starting from autumn last year. So apparently Scholz and his communication team, I think, are a bit cross, but I think the big picture is that it's quite remarkable how a German word can travel the continent and then be adopted across the Atlantic to have such strategic significance for future climate cooperation globally.
Yeah, that's a great word for this segment. And you're right that we don't usually have the words traveling in that direction. We have a lot of English words infused into the German language, but it's nice to have an example of that happening the other way around. All right, so with that, I'll bring us to the end of our episode. If you're still listening, I'm sure you want to learn more about the Transatlantic Climate Bridge, or the TCB, which is a consortium of climate and energy think tanks, consultancies, and NGOs working to improve and coordinate climate policymaking between Germany, the United States, and Canada. At the head of our consortium is my employer, Adelphi, a Berlin-based leading independent think and do tank on climate, environment, and development. Adelphi and its partners, among them Polis 180, run the TCB with the support of our funders in the German federal government. And our activities include writing analysis, putting on events, facilitating government dialogue, organizing exchange programs, and much more. So that is it for this episode. I am Mary, signing off.
And I'm Ole. Thanks for listening, and bis zum nächsten Mal.